The History Show with Mars Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's programme...
In this small area around the docks and that, people spoke completely different English, and also there would be Irish words mixed up in it.
On Gaeilge I Léirfúil, we'll hear about the hidden history of the Irish language in Liverpool. Plus...
He hadn't got the big ego that, you know, some politicians have, and it didn't bother him as long as the movement could be successful.
The life and disputed legacy of Arthur Griffith, the founder of Sinn Féin. But to begin this evening, one side effect of lockdown measures around the world is the effect they've had on animal behaviour. It didn't take long for emboldened wild animals to venture into locked down cities, like the wild pumas, for example, that roamed the deserted streets of Santiago in search of food, or the herd of goats that took over an empty town centre in Wales. Wild deer, raccoons, turkeys and other creatures were spotted in urban settings that they might normally avoid. Back in the 19th century, though, it was common to see all kinds of animals on the streets of Dublin. To talk about this, I'm joined now by historian Juliana Edelman, author of the book Civilised by Beasts, Animals and Urban Change in 19th Century Dublin. Juliana, you're very welcome to the History Show.
Thanks for having me, Miles.
Now, we've seen a lot of examples of animals taking back human spaces while the world is in lockdown, but back in the period that your book covers, animals were a big part of everyday city life. What type of animals are we talking about?
Oh, all kinds of animals, from the domestic animals we associate with a farm, pigs, cows, chickens, sheep even at the market, and horses, of course, for transport and work. And then all kinds of pets, you know, from exotic, you know, people keeping a pet monkey to the ordinary cats and dogs. And then, of course, all the wild animals that we still see today, large amounts of bird life and foxes and things like that as well.
And I suppose something that you don't want to see very much nowadays, rats as well. There would have been plenty of those, I would imagine.
Absolutely. Although, interestingly, it's not really until they're concerned about rats as a cause of disease that rats are just kind of accepted as part of city life. So they're very concerned about rats causing problems with pipes and drains by chewing through things or problems in the house. But they're not maybe quite as obsessed with their eradication until they're linked to plague later in the century.
So give us a sense of the amount of animals like pigs, cows and sheep that were actually kept in the city as opposed to being brought into the city for slaughter or what have you, and how people managed to keep them in an urban environment.
Somewhere around 7,000 to 8,000 horses, fluctuating, went up when the horse trams were at their peak, probably, and then started to decline towards the end of the 19th century. Thousands of cattle, they're a little bit harder to keep track of because, as you already suggested, you know, the rhythm of the market, there would be extra thousands for the weekly market. And then there would be lots of dairy cows, probably somewhere in the region of 3,000 dairy cows on any given day. But they also had rhythms. So during the spring and summer, they might be sent out of the city to graze. Sheep were just passing through, basically, for slaughter and at the market. People would have kept hens. And probably the most surprising animal, because we don't think of it as an animal that we certainly keep in cities now, is pigs. And there would have been huge numbers of pigs. So in the peak year that I looked at, there were about 12,000 pigs kept in the city. And these were kept all over the city. So they were in large lots, you know, basically as part of a bacon making business. But they were also kept individually in people's homes. You know, sanitary authorities were very concerned about people keeping an individual pig actually in the rooms with them, in the same way that we saw that kind of discourse around keeping pigs in the house in rural areas as well. That was also an urban phenomenon.
And were cows, for example, being milked in the city of Dublin in the 19th century?
Oh, yeah, they were being milked in the city of Dublin into the 20th century. First of all, milk was a really important food for everyone, for all levels of social class. It was recognized as a particularly nutritious food. And without refrigeration, you know, you didn't want your milk coming from miles and miles away, becoming sour or growing lots of lovely germs, as they later understood. And so city town milk, as it was called, was a reasonably common phenomenon. And even when they had, you know, longer supply chains and they could keep the milk cool, there was some concern that the sanitary condition of that milk was not necessarily improved just because it was coming from a rural area. And that, in fact, there was a lot of supervision, however loose it was, of dairy yards in the city. And so some people actually preferred to continue getting city milk because they trusted that the sanitary authorities were, you know, trying to keep it clean. Although there were all kinds of outbreaks of disease linked to milk, because milk is a very good medium for growing germs in. So you drop some nice germs into the milk and they say, woohoo, lots of food here. And so typhoid, which was later understood to be a bacterial disease, grew very nicely in milk. So if somebody had dirty hands and milked your cattle, then that milk was going to be contaminated.
What about birds? Was there more bird life in the city than you would see today?
Probably there was. One of the reasons would have been that there was more insects for them to eat, because when you have a lot of slaughterhouses, you also have a lot of flies and a lot of maggots. And so that attracts birds because it's feeding season for them. I have seen in a book on the natural history of London in particular that the population of wagtails, which are those little black and white birds that, you know, they do exactly what it sounds like, their little tail goes up and down, actually declined after the slaughterhouses left because there were less maggots for them to eat. So probably there were more birds even than we experience now.
Now, there are remnants, I suppose they're almost archaeological remnants, really, of how animals were part of the city life all around the capital. Tell us about some of those.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose you would see it in all kinds of things, from the most obvious, you know, the boot scrapers by the side of doors to scrape off the muck from the streets, which would have included a lot of manure, to the names of streets, to anything like the incline of streets and the turns of roads would have been made to accommodate horses and carriages initially, because you know, a horse has limitations in terms of how much weight it can pull going up at a particular angle up a hill. So it would have been important to take that into account, or if you didn't want to have accidents of, you know, horses swinging carriages around too tight corners. And so some of the streets were changed in order to, you know, avoid those kinds of problems. Most of the lanes behind any kind of Georgian era or early 19th century housing are stable lanes, because most of those big houses, you know, you look around the big squares in particular, so Marion Square or Fitzwilliam Square or Mountjoy Square, you know, all around behind those large Georgian houses would have been lanes for keeping your horses, because that was your form of transport. And you see the arches now, they're particularly nicely preserved in a few houses on Henrietta Street, for example. Behind those houses would have been where you kept your horses, your maybe your stable hand lived above where the carriage and the horses were kept. And then actually, as people abandoned using carriages and horses, they were often turned into housing. So where the horses had lived, poor people tended to live.
And was animal welfare taken seriously in the 19th century and early 20th century?
There was a growing movement which very much was influenced by what happened in England. And there were some Irish politicians involved in the initial prevention of cruelty to animals legislation. Humanity, Dick Martin, who was an MP from Galway. But the society that they tried to start in Dublin, that was to be a sort of sister society to the London Society, took quite a while to get off the ground. It was not initially supported by many people. And essentially, they had people who sort of wandered around the streets looking for examples of cruelty. And most of those examples had to do with handling cattle or horses, because that was the vast majority of animals you could see on the street. A lot more crimes relating to cattle in Dublin than in London, because there were more cattle, you know, proportionally. So yeah, there was a movement. It just didn't take off quite until kind of later in the century.
And was there a lot of cruelty to, you mentioned cattle, but also, for example, to horses?
There certainly was behavior that we would definitely consider by modern standards to be cruel. I mean, I think it's hard to understand the attitude towards a horse, although we saw similar attitudes in a way in the recent controversy over Gordon Elliott. You know, the horse was a machine for moving stuff around. And so when your machine was about to collapse, you didn't, you know, feed it up and pet it. You tried to get it to go one more time again, basically.
Of course, the major tragedy that happened during the 19th century, the middle of the 19th century, was the famine. And we know there was a huge influx of people from rural Ireland to Dublin in particular. How did that change the agricultural life of the city, if you like? Did they bring animals with them?
It's hard to say, but it does seem like certainly some people maybe brought with them the habit of keeping, in particular, a pig. And not so much during the famine years because people didn't have any money and they sold their animals. But you can see with other waves of migration that the pig numbers do seem to kind of fluctuate in some relationship to that. You know, the immediate effect of the famine was for people, including people in the cities who were poor and keeping a pig to sell those animals or to slaughter them and eat them. And really the big effect of the famine on the city, I'd say, is in terms of the overall boost to the cattle trade, the livestock trade that happened in the country as a whole, and Dublin's kind of role within that trade.
And then when it comes to exotic animals, you had the establishment in 1831 of the zoological gardens. How did that come about?
Yeah, so again, like the SPCA, you know, Dublin is looking to London and wanting to kind of be on par with other metropolises. They found this zoological society immediately with the idea of creating a gardens, not just giving lectures about animals. And it's really one of the earliest zoological gardens in the world. You know, there's one in Paris, which is not quite the same idea. It's not initially thought of as a public park. They get a site of land from the Lord Lieutenant in the Phoenix Park, and they begin getting gifts initially from London. And it's really seen as a kind of a statement about Dublin's importance and its imperial connections, even from the outset.
Did they know how to look after these animals?
Not really. They accepted a certain amount of mortality. One of the saddest things is the rate of tuberculosis, which spreads among animals who are kept close together, trying to avoid the problems of the weather. A lot of them are kept in tight indoor spaces as well. So there's high death rates. But, you know, they do get better at it over time, and they do hire specialist keepers. But no, they're not super great at taking care of them at the start.
And did everybody have access to Dublin Zoo? Could everybody afford to go and visit Dublin Zoo?
From the outset, they seemed to have the idea of a kind of much more elite space as the zoo had kind of developed in London. But pretty rapidly, they run out of potential people who want to join as annual members. And there's a number of members of the committee who are really interested in enticing the working classes to the zoo as a way of, you know, rational recreation, improving kinds of amusements that would be better than the public house. And so they start these penny days on Sundays, and they're immensely popular, and most people could afford a penny amusement. So, you know, within 10 years of its foundation, it's really a much more mixed social space than a lot of kind of entertainments in Dublin.
Now, one of the characteristics, particularly of 19th century Dublin, was slaughterhouses. There were a lot of them. At what point did the municipal authorities decide this was not a good idea to have slaughterhouses all over the place? We're going to need to get rid of these. When did that happen, and what happened as a result?
So around the middle of the 19th century, when you start having corporate reform and the corporation takes over more public health duties, they start looking at slaughterhouses as one of the big contributors to public health problems. Essentially, what they do is that they hire members of the Dublin Metropolitan Police to act as sanitary inspectors. And it's not just slaughterhouses they're inspecting, but they spend a large proportion of their time inspecting slaughterhouses. And they're essentially, the slaughterhouses are required to get a license, and you're supposed to have some level of sanitation in order to get the license in the first place. And then these police officers go around trying to check up on them to make sure that people who don't have a license are not slaughtering, to make sure your slaughterhouse is clean. In reality, that system is far from perfect, not least of all because police officers and butchers are sort of in a similar kind of social milieu. So whether they're trying really hard to get people to comply is one question. Another issue is that the corporation is kind of more interested in policing the ones that are there and keeping them there than it is in reducing them. So what other cities had tried to do was to set up a public abattoir and force the slaughterhouses to close and use the public abattoir. And then you can inspect all your meat in one place and your streets are not full of the results of slaughtering animals. But actually in Dublin, they pick a piece of land, which people who are familiar with the geography of Dublin is right across from where the cattle market was. And it's outside of the North Circular Road. It's just across the street. There was actually an underground tunnel between the abattoir and the cattle market. Now, both the cattle market and the former abattoir site are public housing. But the abattoir was outside of the city boundary. So the butchers basically made a legal case that they didn't have to use it. So in fact, it takes a very long time for that system to come in place. And up until then, they're just basically walking the streets, trying to make sure that people are whitewashing and cleaning and throwing their waste down drains and not heaping up manure in the yards.
So 19th century Dublin, lots of horses pulling carriages, lots of cattle, lots of slaughterhouses. It must have smelt awful.
Yeah, and don't forget the pigs and the chickens. So, yeah, I mean, I think to our senses, it must have been terrible. And I always think of the huge complaints over the River Liffey as a source of bad smells. You know, when the tide was low and the waste, and apparently people threw their dead pets in there and all kinds of things. So it really stank. But I always wonder, how could they distinguish that stink from the rest of the stink? And I think they were just so accustomed to the smell of the animals. That was just in a way that I don't think we could even imagine. That was just part of the landscape of the city.
Juliana, thank you very, very much indeed for sharing those odours with us. We'll have to leave it there. Juliana's book is called Civilized by Beasts: Animals and Urban Change in 19th Century Dublin. It's published by Manchester University Press. Juliana Edelman, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Thanks.
After the break, the story of the Irish language in Liverpool. Stay with us.
The History Show with Miles Dungan on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. We're looking now across the Irish Sea to Liverpool, a city with a strong Irish heritage. Many of those escaping the Great Hunger in the mid-19th century passed through Liverpool and many stayed. In 1851, for example, Irish-born people accounted for over 22% of the city's population. A significant number of those migrants spoke the Irish language, and indeed some of them spoke no English. Tony Birtle is a Liverpool-born Irish language teacher and the author of the book A Hidden History, The Irish Language in Liverpool, on Gaeilge I Léirfiúil. Tony, you're very welcome indeed to The History Show.
Thank you.
Could you start by telling us a bit about your own background and how you became interested, a Liverpool man, in the Irish language?
Well, I was born here in the city in 1954. My mother and her sisters came over from Ireland to train as nurses before the Second World War, and they became part of the very large Irish community here in Liverpool. I grew up, I suppose, hearing the language in the background. They would kind of use Irish expressions and phrases in their conversations with each other, and they would listen to Radio Athlone, as it was called then, which sometimes broadcast programmes and songs in Irish. So I was familiar with the Irish language, and I was kind of intrigued by it because they didn't seem to speak it very much, unlike the Welsh, for example. The Welsh community would speak Welsh all the time out on the street, or say the Chinese community would speak Cantonese all the time. The Irish community only ever seemed to speak the odd word, and so this made me intrigued by it.
And as far as you know, how far back does the Irish presence in Liverpool go? We tend to think of Liverpool as a very Irish city, but when did that actually begin?
Well, most people point to 1207. That was the year that King John granted Liverpool the status as a borough. He wanted to use it, the small port there, as a base to invade Ireland. And so from 1207 onwards, you get this flow of shipping between Liverpool and Ireland. And this port expanded because of that.
In your book, you cite some fascinating examples of the prevalence of the language in the mid-19th century. Tell us, for example, about the appeal to the Vatican for more Irish-speaking priests.
Yeah, this was a petition in 1842 that was signed by 24,000 Irish people, which represented just about half of the Irish community in the city. they said to the Vatican that many of them were unable to attend confession because they didn't have enough English. And most of the priests couldn't speak Irish, they were English-speaking priests. So the Irish community were being neglected when it came to the sacraments. And so they wanted more Irish-speaking priests to be sent to the city.
Now, you write also, obviously, about the impact of the famine. And as hundreds of thousands of people fled Ireland, cheap fares from Dublin to Liverpool made Merseyside a popular destination. Now, obviously, not all of those people stayed in Liverpool. Many of them went to other English cities. Many of them subsequently migrated to the USA and to Canada. But a lot of them did actually stay in Liverpool, didn't they?
They did indeed. And we have statistics for the numbers of them who spoke Irish for the year 1850, because an Anglican clergyman, Abraham Hume, who was into the use of statistics, he conducted a survey in the area of Liverpool that he worked in near the city centre. And he and his workers went around each house asking people how many people lived in the house and what religion they were and so on. And one of the questions in his survey was, Irish spoken, do you speak Irish? Sure enough, we find in some roads 90% of the people in streets in this area were speaking Irish. So you're talking about thousands of people within a very small area. So this would have represented, you know, a viable linguistic community.
One of the themes of the book is the attitude of both Catholic and Protestant churchmen towards the Irish language during this period. Why did the Catholic Church have, as you put it yourself, an uneasy relationship with the language?
Liverpool is situated in Lancashire, which is the strongest county for Catholicism. These were, you know, indigenous English Catholics. And the Catholic Church seemed to regard the influx of Irish immigrants as bolstering that this was going to make our Lancashire even more Catholic. And they seemed to want those Irish Catholics to assimilate as quickly as possible with the local Catholic Church. And so they did not go out of their way to promote the Irish language, you know, to send over Irish priests, or even name churches after Irish saints. There was comparatively few churches named after Irish saints. So they really wanted Irish Catholics to speak English and just mix with the indigenous Catholic population.
You also write about the Irish language as a vehicle for conversion. What are your particular thoughts on that subject?
Well, one of the tenets of the Reformation was that everybody had the right to read the Bible in their own language. And so the Protestants were very keen to translate the Bible into various languages. And included amongst these was Irish. So you couldn't say it was just Irish that they were targeting. And the Douay English College on the continent, they published a Bible in English, you know, translated from Latin into English in 1610. So the Catholic Church, you know, did, you know, produce a Bible in English to rival the Protestant Bible. But unfortunately, they did not produce a Bible in Irish. Archbishop John MacHale, he translated the New Testament into Irish in 1846, but they didn't get around to translating the Old Testament, you know, the complete Bible, into Irish until about 1981. So really, if the Catholic Church had been concerned about Protestants poaching their members, they should have translated the Bible from Latin into Irish, same way that the Protestants did.
There was a phenomenon in Ireland when it came to the Irish translation of the King James Bible, that if you were literate in Irish, if you could read and write Irish as opposed to just speaking Irish, there was an assumption that you had learnt that from the King James Bible. And there was an assumption also that you had been proselytised as a result. Did you ever come across any examples of that in Liverpool?
Yes, there was a famous incident. A group of poor famine refugees were issued with copies of the Bible and also food. And they were given refuge in an old house. And Catholic priests basically stormed the building. And at the time it said, quote, "Save them from the horrors of the authorized version, which I mean, it's a book, for heaven's sake. It was hardly horrific, and they were getting free food with it as well, so it was perfectly understandable why poor, hungry people might wish to avail of free food and also a free copy of a Bible written in Irish.
So how large was the Irish-speaking community in Liverpool? Was it, for example, at its highest in post-famine years, when there would have been a huge influx from Irish-speaking areas, from Gaelic areas in Ireland?
Yes, it was. As I mentioned earlier, there's 24,000 people signed that petition in 1842. But, I mean, after the famine, just in the year 1847, 300,000 Irish people landed in Liverpool. Between 1845 and 1852, 1,300,000 Irish people crossed over to Liverpool and came through the gates of Clarence Dock. Clarence Dock was the dock where the Irish boats docked. So you're talking about, you know, hundreds of thousands of people speaking Irish. And it's on record as well that many of these people did not speak English. Professor Frank Neil, in his book Black 47, he has a number of coroner's reports, people who died of starvation in the streets of Liverpool, and their family members were unable to give evidence at the inquest because they were unable to speak English.
Now, the Irish language itself wasn't having a great time in Ireland in the latter half of the 19th century, and to some extent, what happens then is the Gaelic revival, the Cumann na Gaeilge, the Gaelic League, that revival at the end of the 19th century. How does that play out in Liverpool?
Well, by coincidence, the founder of Cumann na Gaeilge, Douglas Hyde, that organisation was founded in 1893, and he married a locally born German woman in Liverpool in 1893. So I remember when they were celebrating in 1993, the centenary of the foundation of the Gaelic League, I saw that he'd been married in a church called St. Nicholas. So I approached the vicar there, and sure enough, in the marriage register, there was Douglas Hyde's name signed in Irish, you know, in the old letters, in the old script. So right from the word go, there was contact between Cumann na Gaeilge in Ireland and Irish speakers in Liverpool. And there were already existing Irish classes and Irish language activities going on in the city. And they just linked up with Cumann na Gaeilge when that organisation got going.
Talk to me a little bit also about the Liverpool dialect. People in Liverpool speak English in a very different way to people in London, for example. What kind of specific dialect arose in Liverpool, and do you think there was any contribution to that dialect from the Irish language?
Yeah, well, this was commented on by visitors to the city in the 19th century, that in this small area around the docks and that, people spoke completely different English from that spoken in the rest of Lancashire. And also there would be Irish words mixed up in it. And of course, some of these words survive today, so like that's smashing, you know, that's just is ma shin, which means that's good. What people say is smashing, and expressions like ta-ra, which you know, you'll hear on Coronation Street and so on, that's recognised. It's just been a compressed form of tour ara, take care. And in Liverpool, the people in Liverpool were termed as whackers because of their habit of dressing each other as whack, which of course is just mac, with a shaver went. So you just, hey, whack, you know, for hey, son, you know. So you'd hear people say, you know, ta-ra, whack, which is just ta-ra, a whack, you know. So you'd have these expressions mixed up with the English. Now, obviously, the local people were kind of unaware that they were Gaelic expressions. And sometimes they would be laughed at when they were used outside of the city. But there's plenty of them, all right. You know, the word faso, for example, you hear that used locally. And a slapper, which is a derogatory term for a woman, for a slovenly woman, that just comes from the Irish word slapog, which means the same thing. So there is still quite a few Irish words and expressions mixed up with the English that is in use locally today.
Goramila Mahogath Osokthon Kora Shot. The book is called A Hidden History, The Irish Language in Liverpool, on Gaelge I Léirfol, and it's available online at siopagaelge.ie. Thank you very much indeed for talking to us today on The History Show, Tony.
Fáilte.
After the break, we'll be hearing about the life and legacy of Arthur Griffith.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back. Arthur Griffith is an important figure in Ireland's revolutionary history, as the man who founded Sinn Féin in 1905 served as president of Thall Éireann and chaired the Irish delegation in the Anglo-Irish treaty negotiations. Despite all this, he's often overlooked when we talk about this period, and according to my next guest, his role in modern Irish history is often misrepresented. I'm joined by Colm Kenny, author of the book The Enigma of Arthur Griffith, Father of Us All. Colm, you're very welcome indeed to The History Show.
Thank you.
Now, Arthur Griffith is someone who was a pivotal figure, obviously, in the Irish revolutionary period, but perhaps one who doesn't fit neatly into any single nationalist tradition. Do you think that as a consequence that he's been slightly airbrushed out of Irish history?
I think people definitely have overlooked Arthur Griffith because he makes the picture much more complicated. The kind of easy narrative of independence is made more difficult. This is the man who founded Sinn Féin, who sustained Sinn Féin until after the 1916 rebellion, who was there with the IRB in 1914 at the beginning of the First World War, planning what was to happen during the First World War, who yielded gracefully to De Valera in 1918 because he knew the young bloods wanted a different kind of person in charge, but almost immediately took over as president of the Dáil for most of the War of Independence when De Valera went to America. And then he leads the treaty delegation and he's president of the Dáil in 1921. So why do we not know a lot more about him? I think it's because, you know, despite the fact that Michael Collins reportedly called him Father of Us All, and even on the other side, Harry Boland said, damn it, man, hasn't he made us all? I think that if we start to look at Griffith, it changes our view of the simplicity of the story of the Irish Revolution, as it's called now.
Now, obviously, he was a nationalist, and we can tease out his nationalism over the course of the interview. But just go back to his upbringing. And he grew up in the heart of Dublin. He grew up in poverty. To what extent did his childhood inform his political views?
Griffith was driven by concern about the poor of Dublin and about the economic welfare of the country. In fact, he had a very unusual grasp of economics for his era and wanted to highlight various remarkable controls that were exercised on Ireland in relation to how people could bank and get loans and export goods and how that was controlled and how vital that was. And this grew out of his extreme poverty. His father was very ill and died, and Griffith, living in the heart of Dublin in Summerhill, near Montau, he was very conscious of the exploitation and prostitution that was going on there and campaigned against what was he saw as the exploitation of the women, campaigned with Maud Gonne on that front. But he put off his wedding even to Molly, as he always called her, although she's known as Maud, for years because of his poverty. And his struggle to look after his family and to sustain the newspapers that are nearly forgotten now, but that were a central part of the struggle then. He was an editor of a series of influential small papers like the United Irishman and Sinn Féin itself, the paper of that name. There are many stories told about how little he owned, one pair of shoes, one pair of trousers. One day he had to send the shoes out to be mended and he was walking around the office all day long in his stocking feet. He turned down the offer of more lucrative jobs to keep going with his little newspapers. So yeah, no, a remarkably committed man whose one of his fears was that, for instance, in 1916, that violence that didn't achieve something would rebound against the working class in Dublin. And to some extent it was justified. I mean, in 1916, the working people of Dublin, a lot of them did die and a lot of them did suffer as a result of what happened then.
Now, as you point out, he certainly wasn't in journalism to make his fortune. Therefore, he was in journalism for political reasons, to espouse a political philosophy. So I suppose there was a certain logic then in 1905 when he establishes Sinn Féin. How did it do initially as a political party?
Well, it didn't do very well, to be honest. I mean, it had a few minor victories, but interestingly, he didn't think of it as a party. He thought of it as a movement. And in a way, that's where that phrase comes from, the movement. It comes back to his fear of replicating the Parnellite split. He saw it as a wide movement that would embrace various strands of nationalism and republicanism. And for a long time, it was a ginger group trying to influence others. It didn't always stand candidates in elections because it didn't think that there was any point, but it tried to influence the outcome of events. And it was a lonely struggle for a long time and a difficult struggle. He wasn't always the easiest person to work with, according to some people. But on the other hand, he might never have kept the movement going had he not been forceful in his own way. And it's not, as you know, until the 1918 election that Sinn Féin really comes to the fore. But he was committed very much. He always believed that the democratic struggle was the basis for independence. He saw what was coming. He knew it was inevitable. As the franchise extended, more and more people got the vote. There was going to be an overwhelming and irresistible case for granting Ireland a form of independence, which was more radical in his view and needed to be more radical than Home Rule.
To some extent, he was haunted by the famous article that he wrote, The Resurrection of Hungary, in which he talks about the notion of dual monarchy, which suggested that although he was a nationalist, he certainly wasn't a republican. So where does that article and where does the legacy of that article then place him in the nationalist spectrum?
Yeah, it's a very good question, because you're right. It wasn't, in fact, it was more than an article. But it's amazing that that was a best-selling pamphlet. It was a serialized series, first of all, in his paper. But then when it was produced, it went into reprint after reprint. People were really taken by it. James Joyce had a copy of it, for example, and it influenced James Joyce's work. And yes, he was arguing for what in hindsight might seem like a somewhat conservative notion of a dual monarchy, a bit like in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, going back a bit to what was in Ireland and the United Kingdom before the Act of Union, when we had parliaments in Dublin and London, but one king. But that was a very radical idea. He himself was a Republican, there's no doubt about it. But this was a strategic move. And what is important to remember is that it was more radical than Home Rule. His concept was more radical. But at that stage, there was very little traction for those kind of ideas. There were not a lot of people willing to support the Republican or Sinn Féin idea or notion, and a notion such as complete independence, you know, would have been unrealistic. So he was essentially a politician rather than, you know, an out and out idealist in the sense of just, you know, making demands that were unrealistic. But it has haunted him because it gets thrown back against him and people say, oh, he wasn't a real Republican and he always wanted to settle with the British in London when it came to the treaty. And I think that's a completely backward way of looking at what the actual history of the situation was, where his pamphlet was actually a radical declaration.
Now, on the debit side, there is quite clear evidence of anti-Semitism. Whether or not that was maintained is another question. But talk a little bit about the evidence for anti-Semitism in his writing.
He certainly published anti-Semitic material in the early years, including some he may have written himself. And this arose out of his fierce opposition to the Boer War, against which he canvassed with Maud Gonne and W.B. Yeats. And at that time, there was a lot of anti-Semitism. The Jews were thought to be on the side of the British in South Africa. So anti-Semitism was rife in the socialist and republican area. Now, the strange thing is, Griffith grew out of that, as his entry in a Dictionary of Irish Biography by Michael Laffin says. But that's seldom mentioned. There was quite an interesting amount of material that virtually never gets cited later on, where Griffith firmly declares the place of Jews in any Irish Free State. And he actually, when he dies, the Jewish Students' Union in Dublin sends condolences to his wife. He had very close Jewish friends. His solicitor was Jewish. And what is also forgotten sometimes and doesn't get mentioned is anti-Semitism, you know, is found in other quarters. Jim Larkin certainly published anti-Semitic material. Michael Davitt, who sometimes gets praised because of a letter he wrote condemning the outbreak of anti-Semitism in Limerick, made some quite remarkable anti-Semitic statements in his time. But Griffith has become a kind of a scapegoat for that. It's a convenient scapegoating. He is much more interesting because he grew out of it, in my opinion. But, you know, it's certainly true, and you're correct to say that he published some of it at an early stage. But let's look at the reality of anti-Semitism in Ireland and not try to pretend it can be all dumped on one individual.
Would it be fair to say that he was drifting towards irrelevance and then an accident, if you like, of representation of the 1916 rising brings him back centre stage, as it were, when British journalists, British politicians describe the 1916 rising as the Sinn Féin rebellion, which it palpably wasn't?
Yes, indeed. Well, if Home Rule had been granted and become a reality, then certainly I think Sinn Féin and the whole Republican movement would have been sidelined for an awful long time, including Griffith, because people would have got on with whatever Home Rule was at that stage, even if it wasn't as much as what Griffith and others wanted. What actually happens, it is true that Sinn Féin gets the credit, if you like, for a rebellion in which Sinn Féin as such wasn't as central as some more radical elements in the Republican movement. But Griffin himself had been at a very important meeting in 1914 that was called by Sean T. O'Kelly of the IRB leadership, which sketched out what was going to happen during the war in resisting the British, including plans for a revolt. And most of the people at that meeting died very soon afterwards in one way or the other, many of them, of course, being executed in 1916. But at that meeting, Griffith is given the task, it's, he's spoken to about continuing the propaganda struggle. I mean, he was seen very much as the person who would do that. And it was a very significant thing that Griffith was at that. So he still was involved centrally to that extent personally. But the party, and this is what happens, of course, because the party is associated with the rebellion, some of the people weren't in the party, including possibly De Valera, who I don't think there's really definite evidence that he was a member of Sinn Féin until he became its leader. They suddenly see Sinn Féin as the mechanism and they want to take it over from what they regard as the old guard and take its leadership over, you know. So they do the deal with Griffith that he will become deputy president to De Valera.
And how important is that act of self-effacement in, say, from 1917 onwards, where he defers to De Valera, because others weren't quite as self-effacing? I'm thinking of someone like Count Plunkett, for example.
Yeah, he tended to defer. He didn't see himself as a great leader, funnily enough. I mean, he was always looking for someone else to lead Sinn Féin. He thought William Bulfin might do it at one stage. Even earlier, he thought, you know, of other people. And he was quite happy in one sense to defer. And he was very gracious about it. He made a very gracious speech. And he was very supportive of De Valera when De Valera was in America for most of the War of Independence. So he was that kind of individual. Even during the treaty negotiations, he told his wife, Molly, you know, that he hoped to be out of politics by the following August or September. And of course, he was in fact out of politics, but not in the way he thought, but because he was dead at that stage. So he hadn't got the big ego that, you know, some politicians have. And it didn't bother him as long as the movement could be successful.
Now, 1921, October 1921. There's a truce, it's still holding. De Valera and Lloyd George have been tic-tacking. A delegation is sent to London. Michael Collins and Arthur Griffith are at the head of that delegation. De Valera is back in Dublin. That was obviously a pivotal moment in his career. To what extent was he hoodwinked by the likes, for example, of Lloyd George during those negotiations? And was, to some extent, his good nature, perhaps his naivety, taken advantage of?
Ah, well, that's the million-dollar question, the Netflix series, isn't it? I don't think he was hoodwinked. I think the delegation was under unbelievable pressure. It was probably very foolish to set up the treaty talks in London on the home turf of the British cabinet, where they could go home in the evenings, where they were surrounded, this most powerful group of politicians in the world, by bevies of their own civil servants in their own country's capital. And to send the delegation into that situation on purely logistical grounds was, you know, a case of Daniel in the lion's den. But in terms of the politics of it, I think there had to be a deal done. And Griffith was the man to do it. And De Valera did like say he might need a scapegoat. And Griffith was willing to be that scapegoat when it came to the treaty. I find it very difficult to understand why De Valera didn't go to London. And I started out the book I wrote very much impartial in terms of the traditional split in Irish politics. I grew up in a household where my mother was tended to Fianna Fáil and De Valera, my father to Fine Gael. So I wasn't out to kind of make a point against anybody. But the more I read of the era, the period around the treaty, the harder it was for me to understand De Valera, no matter, you know, how he tried to justify what he did. I mean, Lloyd George was at the head of the British. Why wasn't De Valera at the head of the Irish? And it put Griffith in a very difficult situation. Now, Collins was quite supportive of him and very worried about his health, too. But in the end of the day, Griffith was the leader and he had to do a deal. And I think there were things he could have done better. I think they were sold a pup on the Boundary Commission in the end. And I can't make up my mind whether Griffith just said, well, look, we're not going to do any better. We've got to go with this. The pressure was enormous. I mean, there was a very real possibility that they would be arrested and even executed. Nothing could be taken for granted. And, you know, at some point, the lads, you know, have to decide, sign or not sign. And he made the decision and he didn't sign the treaty. That's a kind of, I think it's a pejorative way to put it in a sense, because that sometimes suggests that he did the deed and nothing could be done about it. What he signed had to be approved by the Dáil, and it was approved by the Dáil, and then it was approved in a general election.
Now, there's another side altogether to Griffith, because he was a very acculturated individual. And he had a very complicated relationship with W.B. Yeats. They had a great influence on each other's lives, but it didn't end well, did it?
It was up and down and not too good. You know, he had an amazing cultural influence. I mean, his paper, The United Irishman, unfortunately is not digitised, because it's a fantastic read and full of cultural material and writers who are really interesting people. And he himself was extraordinary. I mean, he argued, for instance, about separating Oscar Wilde's private life from his writings. When he was in Reading Jail, he got his wife to bring in a copy of the Ballad of Reading Jail, because he knew Oscar Wilde had been in the same jail, and it gets everybody to sign it. And that book survives in the National Library, and it's a wonderful object. He helped Joyce to get published. He defended Joyce. He published a letter by Joyce about the suppression of Dubliners when Joyce couldn't get it published. And Yeats was published widely and extensively by him in the early days, and used to turn up at the office of the newspaper. And they were, Yeats was probably in the IRB, and they certainly both campaigned together against the Boer War and were followed by the secret police around Dublin. And, you know, he publishes plays by Yeats, but they begin to fall out then over Yeats taking the Abbey in a different direction, and it gets very bitter. And later on, they seem to, you know, Yeats makes it known he wouldn't mind like a position in Griffith's cabinet, perhaps. And Griffith recommends him to attend some event in Paris. But it was always up and down. And I think, you know, Yeats sometimes didn't like to be reminded of his earlier youth. And he makes generous comments in the Dáil after Griffith's death, which is more than a lot of people did who didn't speak. But then he writes the famous poem about the gallery, the Hugh Lane Gallery we visited, where he talks about Sir John Lavery's portrait of Griffith and says Griffith is stirring with hysterical pride. And I talk about that in my book because I think it's completely unjustified, either in terms of the context in which the painting was painted or the actual painting itself. But it has done a lot of damage, I believe, to Griffith's reputation, this notion that he was hysterical.
Can we conclude by applying the great Michael Collins counterfactual to Arthur Griffith? What kind of role do you think he would have played in Irish politics had he not died prematurely in August 1922?
Griffith did say during the treaty discussions to his wife, or his wife said, he said, that he wanted to get out of politics. But I doubt he would have actually done that. I think he would have continued to be a moderating force, and he would have tried to apply social and economic principles, and we would have had a more constructive 1920s than we did had Arthur Griffith lived.
Well, the book is called The Enigma of Arthur Griffith, Father of Us All. It's published by Irish Academic Press. The author is Colm Kenny. Colm, many thanks indeed for joining us on The History Show this evening.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's all we've got time for on this evening's programme. Details of all our items, as well as podcasts, are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. Our researcher is Liz Gillis. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.